One minute, you're Hollywood's highest paid star, beloved by millions for your innocent comedy. The next, you're arrested for murder, your film's banned nationwide, and newspapers describe you as a monster. This wasn't a fictional plot. This was Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle's reality in 1921, when a party at San Francisco's St. Francis Hotel destroyed everything he'd built. But here's what makes these old Hollywood scandals so fascinating. They're not just gossip from a bygone era. They're mirrors reflecting how America has always wrestled with fame, morality, and the uncomfortable question of who gets forgiven and who gets destroyed. When Ingrid Bergman had a child out of wedlock in 1950, senators denounced her on the floor of Congress. Today, such news barely registers. These stories reveal something deeper than celebrity drama. They show us how our culture decides who deserves redemption and who doesn't. Before the 1910s, nobody cared who appeared in movies. The technology itself was the attraction, those jerky images of moving trains and workers leaving factories. Early cameras were so unwieldy that close-ups were nearly impossible, keeping audiences at arm's length from the performers. But as cameras improved and filmmakers discovered the power of the human face in close-up, something shifted. Audiences began recognizing performers, developing attachments, wanting to know more about these people who moved them. Studios manufactured personalities as carefully as films, transforming actors into curated products. Women were marriage-seeking or married. Men were eligible bachelors or devoted husbands. Every detail countered fears that Hollywood corrupted America's youth. Studios and gossip magazines partnered to create intimate access through selected details about stars' homes and habits. When facades cracked, scandals made the public more ravenous rather than destroying Hollywood, teaching the industry containment strategies that persist today. Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks should have been ruined. She was America's sweetheart, playing innocent children despite being in her 20s. He was the athletic hero, performing death-defying stunts. Both were married when they fell in love. Divorce in 1920 was scandalous, yet when they married each other, America celebrated. Their honeymoon tour sparked global mania. Back in Hollywood, Fairbanks leaped from their car to greet his animals, then jumped fully clothed into their pool, a perfect snapshot of their carefree joy. For the next decade, their estate, Pickfair, became Hollywood's unofficial White House, where they curated guest lists and decided which stars could represent the industry. They portrayed themselves as devoted homebodies, a quiet lifestyle partly real, partly embellished to emphasize their class and gentility. The scandal of their relationship never materialized, not because of exceptional publicity management, but because audiences found them irresistibly likable. Their success proved a lesson Hollywood would repeat endlessly. The right romance, properly played, can diffuse any scandal. Arbuckle's fall was swift and merciless. At a Labor Day weekend party in 1921, Virginia Rapp became violently ill in Arbuckle's hotel suite and died days later from peritonitis caused by a ruptured bladder. The press pursued the story with savage intensity, describing fatal wine orgies and publishing increasingly lurid rumors that he'd crushed her with his weight, that he'd assaulted her with a bottle. The truth likely mattered less than what the public wanted to believe about a man of Arbuckle's size, wealth, and profession. Rapp had suffered from chronic cystitis for years, likely causing her death, but facts couldn't compete with narrative. Cities banned Arbuckle's films nationwide. The scandal prompted studios to form the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America, appointing Will H. Hayes to avoid government censorship. Hayes banned all Arbuckle films, instituted mandatory morality clauses in star contracts, and developed content guidelines for decades. Despite three trials and eventual acquittal, with the jury declaring a great injustice has been done, Arbuckle's career was finished. He directed under pseudonyms for a decade before briefly returning to on-screen comedy in 1932. Just as a comeback seemed possible, he died in his sleep the night he signed with Warner Bros., aged 46. His body became his crime, his size the evidence of his guilt. Wallace Reed dominated silent films as the all-American boy next door, 6'3", 190 pounds of strapping good looks. When he died from withdrawal complications in 1923, his wife Dorothy Davenport and Will Hayes reframed addiction as victimhood and heroism rather than moral failure. His reported last words, "Tell them, Mama, I have won my fight," cemented his image as a conquering hero. Reed's addiction narrative evolved strategically, initially blamed on morphine from illness, then a train accident. Each version portrayed him as selfless, too dedicated to fans, working through pain until temptation overwhelmed him. Davenport, his ministering angel, collaborated with Hayes on Human Wreckage, an anti-drug film serving as Reed's memorial. This shifted blame from Reed and Hollywood to drugs and dealers. By 1925, nostalgic remembrances erased the addiction entirely. The lesson? With proper framing, even fatal addiction could become inspiration. Clara Bow embodied everything exciting and terrifying about the 1920s new woman. She was praised for appearing genuine while expected to disavow her flapper lifestyle off-screen. Her role in It captured this perfectly, a girl unaware of her beauty, seemingly indifferent to men, yet irresistibly attractive. The film presented the classic paradox, independence as merely a path to dependence through marriage. By 1929, Bow's image unraveled. Her engagement to Harry Richman was ridiculed, affair rumors spread, and the press mocked her weight gain. Gambling debts surfaced when she stopped payment on casino checks. The devastating blow came from former Secretary Daisy DeVoe, who, after their falling out, was arrested for theft. Bow's trial exposed excessive spending on men. Though nothing illegal surfaced, tabloid allegations proved irreversible despite the editor's imprisonment for extortion. Bow suffered a nervous breakdown in 1931, and Paramount severed her contract. The woman who personified female independence became a cautionary tale. Studios tested boundaries with pre-code cinema, films that flaunted rather than followed the rules. Leading this assault were Jean Harlow and Mae West, both affronts to traditional respectability. Harlow's platinum hair and predatory gaze made men feel like prey. West's bulldozer personality in skin-tight gowns reset beauty standards with sequined curves. Both represented something dangerous, women who enjoyed sex without shame. When Harlow's husband, Paul Byrne, committed suicide 2 months after their wedding, MGM crafted a narrative of resilience. Red Dust, released 6 weeks later, grossed triple its budget. To deflect affair rumors, MGM orchestrated a hasty marriage to cameraman Harold Rawson, an 8-month union that served its purpose. By 1934, the Legion of Decency branded Harlow objectionable. MGM sanitized her image. Brown hair, virtuous roles. At her 1937 peak, her health collapsed. She died from uremic poisoning. Rumors claimed platinum treatments poisoned her. Medically dubious, but poetically perfect. Mae West stood apart, writing her own material, avoiding Hollywood nightlife, never engaging in high-profile romances. Her frank approach was revolutionary, sex as natural as eating. Her 36-26-36 figure sparked a Depression-era curves craze. Publicity portrayed her as impeccably moral, no drinking, smoking, church regular. Censors gradually muted her ribald humor. Unlike Harlow, West refused compromise, becoming a relic of permissiveness. She never achieved sustained mainstream success, but maintained something more valuable, integrity. She proved the greatest scandal isn't what you do, it's refusing to apologize. These stories aren't historical curiosities, they're blueprints for consuming celebrity today. We still build stars up to tear them down, demand authenticity while punishing realness, use scandal to police gender and sexuality. Technology changed, fan magazines to Instagram, but dynamics remain eerily similar. What shifted is who gets forgiven. Arbuckle was destroyed by false accusations. Bow was ruined for living what her film celebrated. Harlow and West were punished for embodying female sexuality. Yet Pickford and Fairbanks were celebrated for divorces that would have destroyed less likable stars. The difference wasn't the transgression, it was narrative control. These scandals reveal something uncomfortable. Our relationship with fame has always been transactional and cruel. We demand stars be simultaneously extraordinary and relatable, sexual but pure, ambitious but humble. When they inevitably fail these impossible contradictions, we act shocked, as though we didn't create conditions for their downfall. Every generation believes its celebrity culture uniquely toxic, but we've been here before, building golden pedestals, lighting fires beneath them, watching flames with horrified fascination. The problem isn't the stars, it's the pedestals themselves.